Welcome to Haunted Canada. Hi, everyone. My name is Nadine, and welcome back to Haunted Canada. If you are a first-time listener to this podcast, thank you for joining us. And if you are a repeat listener, I want to sincerely thank you for coming back. If you are truly enjoying the Haunted Canada podcast, please take the time to give us a like, follow us, and give us a 5-star review. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok for all the updates. On episode 9 of Haunted Canada, we're going to talk about 3 more Canadian ghost stories. First, we're going to start with the story of Catherine Snow, the last woman hung in Newfoundland in 1834. Then, we're going to visit Fort Sand Sanatorium in Fort Capel, Saskatchewan, to hear the haunted story of the building that was once used as a sanatorium after World War I to help those suffering from tuberculosis, and today is now known as one of the most haunted buildings in Saskatchewan. And for the third story, we're going to head to Saskatoon to delve into the story of the very historic and haunted Mar residence. Catherine Snow was the last woman hung in Newfoundland in 1834 as she was found guilty for her part in the murder of her husband and was sentenced to death. However, during the trial, it was discovered that she was pregnant. And while many people believed in her innocence, this didn't seem to bother the local justice system. The governor at the time decided to spare the unborn child, with Catherine's hanging being postponed until after she delivered the baby. Catherine Mandeville was born in the outport community of Harbor Grace, Newfoundland in 1793. Then, on October 30, 1828, she married local fisherman and farmer John William Snow. The couple settled in Salmon Cove, which is on the Avalon Peninsula, and was the ideal spot for John Snow to fish and farm to provide for his growing family. It was close enough to the Atlantic Ocean and would provide them with a source of income. John and Catherine Snow had 7 children together: John, Kate, Martin, Amelia, Maria, Thomas, and Joanna. Life was not easy during that time period and would have consisted with trying to survive every day, with John fishing, then cutting, gutting, and cleaning the fish on his stage, otherwise known as a wharf, to sell to make money for the family, while Catherine was at home taking care of their 7 children. It seems, though, that John Snow had a temper and was a violent man, with the marriage being full of domestic violence. Even though John could be a violent and abusive husband towards his wife Catherine, many times she didn't stand for it, and she would often stand up for herself, fighting back against her husband by throwing things at him as a means of self-defense, and their fighting could be heard throughout the small community. This was the 1830s, and under the English common law, women were considered the property of their husbands, and domestic violence wasn't even a term that was in anybody's vocabulary at the time. Women had 0 rights, and at that time in history, were not considered equal to men. Sadly, when a man was violent towards his wife or family, this never got any attention during that time period, as it was often considered to be a personal family matter, and nobody ever intervened to help. However, eventually, Catherine found friendship, happiness, and love with her first cousin, Tobias Mandeville, who was the complete opposite of her husband. Tobias was kind, gentle, and made Catherine laugh, and eventually the two fell madly in love with each other. While Catherine and Tobias may have thought that they were keeping their affair a secret, as they lived in such a small community that was full of nosy people who loved to gossip, the rumors quickly spread among the small Salmon Cove community that Catherine and Tobias were a little bit too close for comfort, and soon John caught wind of the rumors. He confronted his wife, and his anger quickly turned to violence. However, like most women in the 1800s, Catherine had no way to escape the domestic violence that she was living in. Tobias had fallen so deeply in love with Catherine, his first cousin, and he wanted to free her from the abuse of Jon Snow, as he hated the way that Jon treated Catherine and how cruel and violent he was towards the woman that he loved, soon realizing that the only way that the two could ever be together was to get rid of Jon Snow. But Tobias could not do this alone, so he enlisted the help of Jon Snow's indentured servant, Arthur Spring, to help him kill Jon Snow. Being an indentured servant, Arthur Spring was subject to long days, harsh working conditions, and beatings as he was the property of his master, Jon Snow. It was a cruel existence, and when Tobias approached Arthur that he could seek revenge upon his abusive employer, it didn't take long for Arthur to agree to be part of the plot to murder his tormentor. Arthur quickly came to the chilling realization that his escape and liberation could only be attained by killing his employer. On Saturday, August 31st, 1833, Jon Snow disappeared and was believed by many in the community to have been murdered. Over the next several days, Jon's boats did not move from the stage, which was noticed by many people in the community of Salmon Cove. And that's when the rumors and the gossip began to spread that Jon had disappeared and was believed to have been murdered. As Jon had not been seen for a couple of days, eventually, some of his family members reported him missing. Magistrate Robert Pinsent was notified and began to investigate the reports from neighbors that Jon Snow was missing and may have been murdered. As the magistrate began to check around Jon's stage, he discovered blood and immediately believed all the growing rumors that Jon had been murdered, as that was now the common talk around the community, even though no body was ever discovered. Tobias and Arthur were brought to the courthouse in Harbor Grace and questioned, with both of them immediately confessing to their part in the murder of Jon Snow. Both men stated that they had attacked Jon on the fishing stage that Saturday night. A fight broke out, and Jon was shot. Then the two men took Jon's body out into the deep water of Salmon Cove, tied an anchor around his body, and dropped him into the deep, dark Atlantic Ocean. Both men were arrested immediately upon confessing. When Catherine heard that Tobias and Arthur had been arrested, she ran off into the woods to hide. But after a few days, with lack of food and shelter, she soon turned herself into the courthouse in Harbor Grace. Catherine gave two statements to the magistrate. One saying that she didn't know what happened the night that Jon was murdered. And the second statement saying that her husband Jon had gone outside that night, she heard a shot, and he never returned. Both Tobias and Arthur, who were arrested on suspicion of murder, were being held in jail. However, it seems that Arthur Spring, the indentured servant, his conscience got the better of him. It was a short time later that Arthur summoned the magistrate back to the jail cell to confess even more details of the brutal crime and to implicate Catherine Snow in the murder. Arthur Spring stated that, "We killed him, Tobias, myself, and Mrs. Snow, shooting him dead and sinking him in the Atlantic with a grapnel." There was no way to determine which man pulled the trigger, as while in jail, both Tobias and Arthur were putting the blame on each other, accusing the other man of pulling the trigger that ended the life of Jon Snow. Though the two men each tried to blame the other for being the one that actually pulled the trigger, Catherine Snow always maintained her innocence. All three individuals were kept in jail until their trial began on January 10, 1884, which was presided over by Chief Justice Judge Bolton. When the trial began, all three pleaded not guilty, and the trial began with an all-male jury. Catherine Snow and her cousin Tobias Mandeville were represented by the same lawyer, George Henry Emerson, while Arthur Spring's lawyer was Brian Robson. The Attorney General told the all-male jury that, "I can't prove which one fired the shot. Both were present for the murder. As for Catherine Snow, there is no direct or positive evidence to her guilt, but I have a chain of circumstantial evidence to prove her guilty." In the early 1800s, during that time period, women had no rights. They were considered the property of their husbands, and between town gossip and innuendo, it didn't take much for the community to spread around the story that Catherine and Tobias were having an affair and that she had partaken in her husband's murder. Her arrest was based on circumstantial evidence from the alleged blood on the fishing stage painted her as the evil wife and mother who was having an affair, though there was no direct evidence against her. During the trial, Catherine Snow had discovered that she was pregnant with her eighth child. Yet even when she informed the court that she was pregnant, she still was not believed, and the court sought out to prove whether or not she was telling the truth. The local newspaper, the Royal Gazette, wrote that 12 respectable matrons should be impaneled to decide on the truth or falsity of the prisoner's allegations. The 12 matrons met on Saturday morning and returned a verdict that the prisoner was in the situation stated in her plea. Basically, the courts didn't believe Catherine and assumed that she was lying about her pregnancy, so they sent 12 women into the prison to physically examine her. And upon the examination, it was confirmed that yes, Catherine Snow was indeed pregnant with her eighth child. The trial took place on Thursday, January 10, 1884, and only lasted 12 hours, with the only evidence being that Thomas and Arthur had confessed, each blaming the other for shooting John Snow. But at the end of the day, no body was ever discovered. And as for Catherine, there was no evidence that implicated her in her husband's murder. It was all circumstantial. However, after only 3 hours of deliberation, the all-male jury returned with a guilty verdict for Catherine Snow, Tobias Mandeville, and Arthur Spring. The judgment read, Tobias Mandeville was found guilty of murder and was sentenced to be hung by the neck until dead, and his body to be dissected and anatomized. Arthur Spring, the servant, and Catherine Snow, the wife of the deceased, were declared guilty of treason and accordingly sentenced to be hung by the neck until dead, and their bodies, after death, also given to the surgeons for dissection. On Friday, January 31, 1834, 21 days after being found guilty and sentenced to death, Arthur Spring and Tobias Mandeville, both wearing blue jackets, white trousers, and white gloves, were hung from the second floor of the St. John's Courthouse on Duckworth Street, from a makeshift scaffolding outside the second floor window that would act as the gallows. Reverend Fleming was with both men the entire time to perform religious duties and give spiritual guidance. Hundreds of people had gathered on the surrounding streets to watch both men hang for the murder of John Snow. Their bodies were not dissected as directed by the court's original ruling. Instead, their bodies were taken to Portgrave and displayed in a gibbet on Spectacle Hill near Cupid's. Gibbeting was a common punishment that a judge could impose as an addition to being executed and stems from the English Murder Act of 1751. It was sometimes referred to as a fate worse than death and was used as a way to deter other people from committing similar crimes. Even though Catherine had been found guilty, she was still pregnant, and the governor of Newfoundland, Thomas John Cochrane, decided to delay her hanging by 6 months. Catherine was allowed to carry the child to term, give birth, and then nurse the baby for the first few months of infancy, at which time her execution would then take place. Many Newfoundlanders protested against Catherine being hung as they viewed her as an innocent person. Bishop Michael Fleming, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Newfoundland, made Catherine Snow's case a cause for célèbre, which meant that the bishop had raised such a fuss about what he believed to be an inhumane treatment of Catherine that the topic became a very controversial issue that attracted a great deal of public attention, which is why so many Newfoundlanders at the time got behind this opinion and signed a petition that Catherine was innocent, wrongfully convicted, and should not be hung. Through it all, Catherine would spend the remaining months in her jail cell, feeling her unborn child moving in her belly, knowing that each day would only bring her closer to her eventual death. Catherine Snow gave birth in February 1834 to a beautiful baby boy that she named Richard Snow, and the newborn baby was baptized on March 22, 1834, in the Roman Catholic Chapel on Henry Street in St. John's. the baby's sponsors in the baptism were James Kelly and Miss Purcell. The baby, Richard Snow, was the talk of Newfoundland at the time. His father had been murdered, and his mother, who was found guilty of killing the baby's father, was sentenced to be hanged. During Catherine's trial, imprisonment, and the birth of her son, Catherine had gained many supporters and a lot of public sympathy from those who believed in her innocence. One of her biggest supporters was the local Catholic bishop, Michael Anthony Fleming, who not only petitioned for her release and a retrial, he also took guardianship over her other seven children. Many people firmly believed that they wouldn't hang Catherine Snow. Why would they have let her give birth to a baby only for it then to be orphaned? Also, Catherine's lawyer had tried many times unsuccessfully to get her guilty verdict overturned or to have a new trial. However, this was all for naught. For on Saturday, July 21st, 1894, at 8:45 in the morning, Catherine Snow was walked into the scaffolding from the second floor of the courthouse on Duckworth Street, where the noose was placed tightly around her neck. Her hanging in St. John's drew huge crowds, with some people there to watch, while others were there to protest against her execution. Bishop Fleming was next to Catherine the entire time, there to comfort her in those final moments. Catherine maintained her innocence up until the very end, even proclaiming as the noose was put around her neck that she was innocent, stating that, "I was a wretched woman, but I am innocent of any participation in the crime of murder as an unborn child." The St. John's newspaper, the Public Ledger, then reported that the unhappy woman, after a few brief struggles, passed into another world. While Catherine Snow's body was also supposed to be given to the surgeon for dissection, this did not happen due to the protest by Bishop Fleming and the many who believed in her innocence. Catherine's lifeless body was taken down from the gallows at the courthouse in St. John's, and because Bishop Fleming and the Catholic Church supported her and believed in her innocence, Catherine was given a Christian burial and buried at the nearby Old Catholic Cemetery, just a short distance from the gallows. Within a few days of Catherine Snow being hung at the courthouse and buried in St. John's, her ghostly apparition began to make an appearance. People began to report that they would see the figure of Catherine Snow walking throughout the courthouse or standing near the window where she was hung. Even more scary is that people began to see Catherine Snow walking through the old Catholic cemetery where she was buried, a mere 400 meters or just a 6-minute walk from the courthouse where she was hung. It has been noted in many articles that I've read about Catherine Snow's ghosts that in 1894, many prominent members of society and the legal system reported seeing Catherine's ghost at that very courthouse from which she was hung, which gave a lot of legitimacy to the story, with many people believing that the spirit of Catherine Snow had returned to the place where she was wrongfully convicted and that her spirit now wanders throughout the courthouse seeking justice. The present-day courthouse was built on the original courthouse site since 1902, after two separate fires destroyed the former buildings, and it is still believed to hold the spirits of Catherine Snow, with many people who work in the building today often seeing the ghost of Catherine walking in the hallways, up and down the staircases, or, as one person said to me, drifting through the hallways. On other occasions, phantom footsteps can be heard in the hallways when there's nobody there, and the elevator seems to have a mind of its own, moving from floor to floor, with all of this always being blamed on Catherine Snow's ghost. Still to this day, many people believe that Catherine Snow was wrongfully convicted and hung for a crime that she didn't commit back in 1834. In April of 2012, in St. John's, they had a mock retrial of Catherine Snow's case. In the original trial against Catherine, it was all circumstantial evidence, and in the mock retrial, it was all presented to the audience that all the evidence against Catherine Snow was circumstantial. She maintained her innocence while being questioned, and no body was ever found. Another interesting fact that was brought up in the mock retrial was that Catherine Snow and Tobias Mandeville had the same lawyer, and that should never have happened. After all the evidence was presented, the crowd had gathered for the mock retrial, all voted, and it was overwhelmingly agreed that Catherine Snow was indeed innocent. While Catherine Snow was found innocent in this mock retrial, sadly, it doesn't change history, with Catherine Snow still being the last woman hung in Newfoundland. In the eerie stillness of Duckworth Street in St. John's, the foreboding courthouse stands as a silent witness to the dark and twisted past. Within its shadowed walls, the ghostly presence of Catherine Snow, the last woman to meet the gallows in Newfoundland, roams relentlessly throughout the building. Her spirit, consumed by injustice and betrayal, seeking solace in haunting those who dare to pass by. While justice may prevail in the present-day courthouse, the lingering whispers of Catherine's tragic tale sends shivers down the spines of all who cross her path, a terrifying reminder of the unfathomable horror that once sealed the fate of an innocent woman. Deep in the heart of Fort Qu'Appelle, Saskatchewan, lies the ominous and haunted Fort Zan Sanatorium. This desolate and now deserted collection of buildings that opened in 1912 was once a beacon of hope for those afflicted with tuberculosis and now stands as a grim reminder of its tragic and haunted past. The Fort Zan is haunted by the many ghostly apparitions, including the spirit of Nurse Jane, who is often seen wandering through the hallways pushing an empty wheelchair, to the sounds of children's voices, cold spots, and the spirits of the dead bodies that were once held in the morgue, which is now a kitchen. The Fort Zan Sanatorium was originally built and opened on October 17, 1917. It was on a 184-acre property that contained many Tudor Revival and art craft-style buildings scattered throughout the massive property. As soldiers were returning from World War I, many of them needed a place to recover, with many of the soldiers suffering from tuberculosis, otherwise known as TB. Tuberculosis is an infectious disease that often affects the lungs and can be spread when persons with the illness coughs or sneezes. Tuberculosis, often referred to as consumption, was a dominant chronic infectious disease for the first half of the 20th century, and the infection rate increased during World War I. With today's modern medicine, it can be treated effectively. However, in the early 1900s, there was no medicine, and it could actually be a death sentence for many. Men, women, and children affected with tuberculosis also needed a place to rest and recover, and many of them were sent to the Fort Zan Sanatorium Hospital, as it was dedicated to helping people who were afflicted with tuberculosis at that time. The government put a lot of money into the sanatorium to ensure that it had every imaginable medical device and luxury that was necessary for the patients. When the sanatorium opened, it could accommodate 350 patients. And not only did it house soldiers, men and women from World War I, it also took care of the men, women and children that needed the medical attention. As the sanatorium was housing a lot of patients with tuberculosis, the medical staff really wanted to ensure that there was limited interaction so that they could contain the tuberculosis and ensure that it wasn't spread to anybody in the neighboring communities, and that the facility itself was very self-sustaining. The Fort Zan had its own vegetable garden, its own livestock, including chickens and cows. It had a powerhouse that provided all the power to the massive buildings. And there was even a library that was funded and stocked with books from World War I veterans. While the sanatorium wasn't an isolated location, it was truly a place for anyone who needed it. Yet sadly, many people did not survive tuberculosis and died while in the facility. In 1972, the sanatorium closed and the building was sold to the Government of Canada for $1. Over the years, the building has served many different purposes, once being operated as a school for the arts and at another time being used as a convention center. And while the Fort Zan has changed many times over the years, the one thing that has always remained constant are the many ghost stories that remain still to this day. One of the most famous ghost stories surrounding the Fort Zan is that of Nurse Jane, who's believed to have worked at the hospital in the 1920s, doing her best to care for those who are sick. However, sadly, she eventually ended up catching tuberculosis and dying at the hospital. And over the years, many people have witnessed her ghostly apparition wandering throughout the many buildings. Many people have reported over the years that when they worked there or attending a conference, that they would often see the apparition of a woman in a 1920s nurse uniform with a white hat walking through the hallways. But as quickly as they saw her apparition, she would then disappear. Other people would report seeing the apparition of Nurse Jane pushing an empty wheelchair up and down the corridors. But of course, as quickly as they took a second glance, she was gone. One employee who worked at the building when it was an art center reported that every day when he would arrive to work, he would head up to his office on the second floor. Yet while he was in his office, he would often hear wheels squeaking in the hallway. He said that every time he looked out into that hallway, he would often see Nurse Jane wearing her white nurse's uniform with a white cap, pushing an empty wheelchair up and down the hallways. While this did scare him in the beginning, eventually, of course, he got used to it. And every morning when he arrived at work, he would always say good morning to Nurse Jane. While other people who worked at the conference center have reported that when they were in the hallways, they would suddenly see an empty wheelchair appear at the end of the hallway. When they began to walk towards the wheelchair, it then began to roll around the corner. Yet as staff got to the end of the hallway and turned the corner, the wheelchair had vanished. While other people often report Nurse Jane as the folding ghost, that they often report seeing Nurse Jane folding linen and laundry in different rooms on the second and the third floor as well. But again, as quickly as she appears, she then vanishes. There have been many reports over the years that I've discovered in articles and newspapers of a singing ghost. One very interesting story goes back to when the building was an art facility. One day after music practice, a young man had forgotten some of his instruments and some of his paperwork. So he ran back into the room to gather all of his equipment up. Yet while he was in the room gathering up his papers, he began to hear the sounds of a woman singing and also the sound of water running. Now this young man knew that there was nobody else in the building at the time. Everyone had left. But he continued to hear the woman singing. So when he looked out in the hallway, he could hear the singing coming from the men's washroom. As he went over and opened the door to the men's washroom, in the bathroom, standing at the sink, was a beautiful young lady in a blue dress singing. The man also noticed that the water was running. Now, of course, the young man realized that there should be nobody else in the building, so he called out to the woman and said, "Hey, you're not supposed to be in here." But the woman ignored him and continued to sing. But eventually, she stopped singing, looked at her reflection in the mirror, and then just vanished. As soon as the woman had disappeared in front of the young man's eyes, the water then shut off all by itself. The young musician was terrified. He quickly grabbed up all of his materials and ran out of the building. However, one of the most creepiest stories that I came across goes back to when the back section of the building was used as a morgue when it was the Fort Sand Sanatorium Hospital, treating patients for tuberculosis. Sadly, during the tuberculosis time, when people would die within the sanatorium, their bodies were often brought to the morgue that was in the back of the building of the sanatorium that had a big walk-in freezer where their bodies were kept and prepared for burial. When the Fort Sand was turned into and used as a conference center from 1992 until 2004, the former morgue was turned into a kitchen for the conference facility. Over the years, workers would report that when they were in the kitchen preparing meals, that they would often see the ghostly apparition of men, women, and children standing in their hospital gowns just staring at them as the workers were going about their business. Kitchen staff would report that when they'd go into the freezers to retrieve any items that they might need, that they would often see corpses lying on the tables in the walk-in freezers. And staff would report that no matter what time of day it was, that they would constantly hear somebody, almost as if they were standing right next to them, coughing in their ear. Every day at work, staff would report hearing coughing coming from all around them while there was nobody else in the room with them. Lights in the kitchen would go on and off, Pots and pans that were hanging from the racks would begin to shake back and forth, and the cupboard doors would begin to violently open and slam shut continuously, scaring so many employees that they would run out of the kitchen. The history of Fort Zan is as dark as the shadows that dance along the walls. Originally established in 1917, this tuberculosis sanatorium served as a refuge for soldiers returning from the ravages of World War I. These tales paint a vivid portrait of a place where the veil between the living and the dead is perilously thin, where echoes of the past linger with the living. To this day, the echoes of the past still reverberate through the halls of the Fort Zan Sanatorium, a place where the boundary between the living and the dead blurs into obscurity. Dare you venture into its shadowy past, where the ghostly residents of yesteryear still roam, their mourned presence a chilling reminder of the specters that dwell within. In Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, along the historic tree-lined street, is a beautiful Marr residence. Built in 1884, it is the oldest house and most haunted house in Saskatoon, still standing on its original site. The beautiful historic house is of a white and green gable style with a white picket fence going around the entire home. Alexander and Margaret Marr married in 1875, and within 10 years, their family had included now four daughters. Originally, they were living in Ontario, but left to live in Winnipeg for several years. But by the spring of 1884, the Marr family were enticed to move to Saskatoon, as some of the local advertising in the papers described it as a very temperance colony with plenty of fertile land and fresh, clean air. The family traveled by train to Saskatoon and then had to travel the rest of the way by covered wagon. When they arrived, it was not houses and streets that awaited the family, it was tents and huts. The family had no time to sit around and wonder. They had to get busy building a home for their family. The house that Alexander built for his family originally only had the first floor that measured 19 by 24 feet, with the rest of the house slowly being completed over the next 2 years. Once the family home was completed, it was considered to be a pioneer dream house, with a second story, dormant windows, and hardwood floors. Eventually, more people began to settle in the area, with people coming from England, Scotland, and Ontario settling all around them, which grew the community. The Marr Historic Home was once also used as a field hospital during the Riel Rebellion of 1885. Now the house stands as a museum for visitors to walk through and to see how the settlers lived back then and to absorb the important history. It is well known that the Marr residence is just not full with heritage and history, as the house is also known to be the residence of some very distinctive and different ghosts that roam throughout the home. The first ghost is believed to be that of a young girl that is often heard running throughout the home. On many occasions when people witness the young girl's apparition, it appears as if she's dressed in early 1900s attire. People often say that they'll see the little girl peering through the front window. Neighbors who live in the area say that when they're walking by the historic home in the daytime, that they'll often see the young girl, dressed in early 1900s attire, looking out the front window and waving at them. But as soon as anybody waves back, the young girl just vanishes. While the second ghost is believed to be that of a young man in the basement of the home, but it seems that that young man's spirit is not very nice to the females who work in the building. Female staff report that when they're in the home working, that they'll often hear the sounds of a gruff old man telling them to move or to get out of the way. While on other occasions, staff say that when they're going up and down the staircase, they'll often get the feeling as if someone is just pushing them from behind. One employee was noted as saying that one day she was there by herself working in the kitchen, when of course she began to get the feeling as if someone was in the room with her. When she began to hear the sounds of a man yelling at her, telling her to move and get out of the way. When the woman looked around in the kitchen, there was nobody else there with her. When the woman realized that there was nobody else in the building with her, and of course it was just the spirit of the man, she ignored him and went about her business. Over the years, the Marr residence has been a place where numerous paranormal investigations have happened to see if they can make any contact with the spirits of the ghosts that reside in the home. Some recent investigations have recorded the sounds of children laughing. However, what's normally most commonly caught on the recordings is the sound of an angry man telling the people to stop and to leave me alone. The Marr residence in Saskatoon is filled with heritage and history and is well known to be a very haunted location that keeps visitors and employees always guessing as to what paranormal or ghostly experience they will have next. Well, everyone, that is the end of Episode 9 of Haunted Canada. And I want to sincerely thank every single person for taking the time to listen to this podcast and all the other episodes. I truly do appreciate it. If you have enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to support, please take the time to leave a 5-star review. Follow us on all the platforms, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and share the podcast with a friend. Also, if you have any of your own ghost stories, hauntings, or true crimes that you would like for us to cover on this podcast, please email us through our website, hauntedcanada.com. Again, thank you to every single person who has taken the time to listen to this podcast. I truly do appreciate it. Have a good night, everyone, and stay safe.